Welcome to the Holistic Survival Show with Jason Hartman. The economic storm brewing around the world is set to spill into all aspects of our lives. Are you prepared? Where are you going to turn for the critical life skills necessary to survive and prosper? The Holistic Survival Show is your family's insurance for a better life. Jason will teach you to think independently, to understand threats, and how to create the ultimate action plan. Sudden change or worst case scenario, you'll be ready. Welcome to Holistic Survival, your key resource for protecting the people, places, and profits you care about in uncertain times. Ladies and gentlemen, your host, Jason Hartman.
Welcome to the Holistic Survival Show. This is your host, Jason Hartman, where we talk about protecting the people, places, and profits you care about in these uncertain times. We have a great interview for you today, and we will be back with that in less than 60 seconds on the Holistic Survival Show. And by the way, be sure to visit our website at holisticsurvival.com. You can subscribe to our blog, which is totally free, has loads of great information, and there's just a lot of good content for you on the site. So make sure you take advantage of that at holisticsurvival.com. We'll be right back.
Now's your opportunity to get the Financial Freedom Report. The Financial Freedom Report provides financial self-defense in uncertain times, and it's your source for innovative, forward-thinking investment property strategies and advice. Get your newsletter subscription today. You get a digital download and even more. The price, only $197. Go to jasonhartman.com to get yours today.
It's my pleasure to have Joel Skousen on the show today. He is the author of Strategic Relocation, as well as many other works and his weekly articles and so forth, and you'll hear all about those. But this book is just a fascinating book. I discovered it while visiting a friend of mine in Utah, and I just couldn't believe how incredibly detailed it is, how complex it is, frankly, and how it evaluates so many different areas in terms of their value, in terms of survival and safety in a crisis situation. So I'll let the author talk about it himself. And Joel, welcome to the show today. How are you?
Thank you, Jason. It's good to be with you.
Well, likewise. So you're talking to us today from Provo area in Utah, and I guess you also have another home in Portland, right?
Portland area in Hood River, Oregon.
Good, good. And how did you come to write this book on strategic relocation? What was the inspiration for it?
Well, I came from a long background of constitutional conservatives. My uncle was W. Cleon Skousen, who wrote The Miracle of America, and is really one of the modern founding fathers of the constitutional movement. He also wrote a book, which I read when I was a teenager, called The Naked Communist, and it had some very strange anomalies in it about how our own government helped bring Mao to power, helped bring Castro to power by cutting off military aid to Batista, cutting off military aid to Chiang Kai-shek, undermining the Somoza regime in Nicaragua, and many other things like that. And I got the feeling, you know, I don't think we can really trust our government. They talk one thing, they talk anti-communism, and yet they do so much to foment and give aid and trade. You know, even in the Vietnam War, where I was a military pilot for the Navy Marine Corps, I found out that we were fighting with one arm tied behind our back. It was our own government that was causing us to lose the war. And so I came out of the military deciding that I think things are not going to turn out well in this world. I think we better prepare for a great many things. And I developed the concept of the survival home, went into architecture, started the movement on survival architecture, how to design homes that could operate in a crisis as well as in good times. And I wrote the book, The Secure Home. It's been a bestseller for many years, the pioneer in the field. And as I developed an architectural career of consulting with people about safe and secure housing, I found that there was a dying need for people who were saying to me as they were consulting with me about architectural design, am I in the right place? Is this a safe place? Am I throwing all this money into a secure home for naught? And some of them were. Some of them were, you know, in the outskirts of New Jersey, close to the New York area, and they would have been overwhelmed in a crisis. And so I began consulting in strategic relocation. I ended up writing a book on it. This is the third edition, which you hold in your hands, and it's about three three-fourths new material from the older editions.
Which was originally 1997, right?
That's correct.
Yeah, and it's interesting. When did you start on this? The Secure Home book, for example, and Survival Architecture. When did you write that book?
That was 1976.
Okay, so you've been thinking this way a long time, then. This is not in light of recent economic and political developments.
That's right. These are threats that I saw coming many, many decades ago.
And do you think the threat is worse nowadays? I have a feeling I know the answer. But,
even the mainstream is waking up. You listen to television about the debt crisis, which is insolvable. I mean, there's no way that every taxpayer in America has $30,000 to $60,000 to give to the government to pay off the debt is never going to get paid off.
Well, it's really probably about $200,000 per person.
Well, if you look at...
It depends how you look at it. Yeah.
Total obligations of the federal governments, the unfunded obligations, you're exactly correct.
The entitlement time bomb, I call it.
It's something that's never going to get paid off. It's simply a matter of kicking the can down the road. It is my personal feeling that because of my analysis as editor of the World Affairs Brief, which is a weekly news analysis service I do on world affairs, it's been my analysis for many years that, well, a lot of Americans don't understand that the United States has been aiding and abetting the rise of communism even during World War II. Then at the end of World War II, under the guise of Lend-Lease, we gave the Russians the rest of the atomic blueprints to make their first atomic bomb, the ones that they couldn't figure out from what they had stolen in the Manhattan Project. We gave them the first uranium so that they enriched uranium so that they could produce their first atomic weapon. We've done an awful lot, including covering for the continued rise of Russia and rearming towards a nuclear missile power and China as well.
But Joel, you know, I've got to ask you and play devil's advocate with you on that. I mean, how do you know that? If you asked any government agency or representative, they would, of course, deny that. I mean, why would the U.S. do that? And how do you know they did?
Well, we have the diaries of Major Jordan, for example. He's the one that intercepted those plans and the uranium going through the Montana Air Base on its route to over Siberia. And it's all in his book, Major Jordan Diary, about how he called the White House in the Roosevelt administration and talked to Harry Hopkins, and he chastised him for stopping and that material and told him to send it on to Russia.
Well, okay, so that's the how you know. But what do you think the motivation would be? Is it just a spy that's getting paid, a traitor? Or is it something more significant than that and more institutionalized?
Well, one would think initially that this is just a bunch of spies in the Roosevelt administration, and there were communists in them, according to various testimony. But there's a pattern that goes beyond. It went into the Truman administration, the betrayal of our troops in Korea, for example, through and the failure to attack the Chinese across the border that MacArthur ran into. And it happened during the Eisenhower administration, then during the Kennedy administration. And my belief in the motivation is a subject for another interview, perhaps sometimes. It's outlined in my website under a title, Strategic Threats. I outline what I believe is this globalist theory of getting us into a new world order and using conflict and war to create the crisis that drives people into accepting things, like 9/11 drove people in accepting a diminution of
So that's the false flag argument, and I sort of spoke over you there. So I wanted to say, you said 9/11 drove people into accepting less freedom, Patriot Act, etc. That's what you're going to point out, right?
Well, but that's a false flag is only a small portion. We're talking about major war creation. The World War II was set up specifically and induced. I could tell you incredible stories about how Hitler was reluctant to bomb London, and Churchill had meetings with his advisors and told him to go bomb the Ruhr country. We've got to induce Hitler to bomb London. And so we did the first firebombing of the Germans in order to induce that. Now, that isn't to say that Hitler was a nice guy. I'm just saying the Western leaders were involved in exacerbating and creating the conditions for post-war hatred of the West, and the firebombing of Dresden was totally unnecessary. The giving away of all of the Eastern European nations to Hitler or to Stalin at the end of the war Operation Keelhaul, where you took all of the soldiers who had fought on the Allied side, who belonged formerly to pre-Soviet states, were taken back and thrown into the arms of Stalin. We left 5,000 American troops with Stalin and never reclaimed them and kept it secret from America. Tremendous amount of evil that has gone on in the world, setting the stage for future wars. And it's my considered opinion that we're headed for World War III, at least probably a decade down the line with Russia and China. And so that type of threat does deal very strongly with my view that people need to prepare strategically for safety. And especially when you look at a nuclear scenario where about 15 to 20 American cities might be nuked someday, where the military-industrial complex is integrally involved with the city, people need to be out of those cities. They need to be not living in San Diego when that time comes, not living in Seattle. These are dead cities. Colorado Springs, they moved out NORAD into an open Peterson Air Force Base in Colorado Springs, and it makes the city vulnerable. Omaha, Nebraska, Washington, D.C., and New York City, of course, are targets. Newport News, Harbor, Jacksonville, Florida, Kings Bay, Georgia. Tremendous amount of major nuclear targets that I outlined in my book. Now, that isn't the only threat.
Yeah, oh no, you outline a lot of other threats, and I want to talk to you about those. But it's just interesting, and I really would like to have you back and do maybe another show on this, Joel, is the globalist agenda that you mentioned a few minutes ago. I just can't understand the reasons. They're just not compelling enough to me. I mean, I see that there are reasons that people would want to sell America out like this. It's really amazing to me, this great experiment in human liberty that has lasted so far 230-some-odd years. And it's a real sad time. It definitely is. But it makes me think that hasn't every generation and at every time throughout history, haven't there always been people who said the sky is falling and who feared the worst, but it didn't happen? Well, sometimes it did happen. Can you address that just for a moment before we move on into the specifics?
Jason, it's very important because I do run into this all the time. It's important to realize that the media just simply has undermined this, and the government is actively covering for Russian Chinese military preparations. If they would broadcast about Russia and China what they're broadcasting about Iran, you would have people up in arms. Why aren't we doing something about it? When there's a total silence, when there's only three analysts, myself included, in the United States that are predicting a third world war with Russia and China, you know there's a major disconnect between what the government is warning people.
Let me ask you a question about that. So are you saying that in this potential third world war, that Russia and China will be allies against the U.S.?
Yes, they are already allies in that regard. And I mean, let me give you an example. In 1997, there was a front page article in the New York Times, front page, showing a satellite photo of Yamato Mountain. This is an underground bunker complex as big as the Washington, D.C. area in the Ural Mountains that Russia was building as a great big nuclear bunker complex. And they went to the CIA and they asked him, well, what do you think about Yamato Mountain? What's the problem? And they said, oh, it's nothing. It's just defensive. We're not worried about it. Well, in point of fact, there isn't a single person in the United States, in our military, in intelligence, who's ever been inside Yamato Mountain. How could they say it was defensive? They were covering. And in fact, I've seen the satellite photos. Russia maintains it's a mining complex, but there are never any mining cars going in and out once the excavation was done. Only rail-type cars and where factories are being produced down in there. I mean, if I know this as a private intelligence person, certainly the government knows that. Why are they covering for that? Why are they denying that Russia's a threat? Why are they pretending that they're an ally?
Well, what is your answer then? Why are they?
I believe that they're in fact want that, basically, and I've had contacts within the CIA who have told me, look, we've got instructions not to ever badmouth the Soviet Union, and we're to downplay anything that comes up about China. Now, why? I think there's a globalist agenda to create a third world war because, and we can discuss at some point, you know, why people want to undermine American sovereignty in favor of global government. It's a little bit more than just power and money. This is a problem that's been going on for many, many years where these globalists have, in fact, and you may say, well, what's the evidence? Well, believe me, I could regale you with about 15 major quotes from people indicating just what I'm telling you, admitting it.
Hey, listen, and I'm playing partially devil's advocate. I mean, I believe in the globalist agenda. I mean, I don't believe in it from a philosophical standpoint, but I believe it exists. I'll say that. And I'm just asking some clarifying questions there. It does amaze me, though. And you don't have to convince me, but I just wanted you to expand on that for the listeners a bit. But Joel, getting into the book here, you cover just the U.S. or just North America?
North America. I used to, in the previous editions, I'd covered Mexico as part of North America, but it's so out of the question now that I don't even cover that. But I do cover internationally. The whole and first section is on international retreats for safety, and I rate them. I talk about the fact that in the long term, there's too many people that look to Costa Rica and Latin America or South America because they can get a cheap living right now, but they can't guarantee that any of that's going to remain the same. If war starts, if the balance of power changes, if the U.S. is no longer looked upon as a major force that can intervene in their countries, my personal opinion, having lived in most of those countries and knowing the high percentages of socialists and Marxists that are in the bureaucracies there, that American bank accounts, American property rights are going to be worth nothing. And I think it's going to be very difficult to get back to the United States under conditions of war or social unrest. One of the points that I make that's very important in the book is that even though our country's government is the problem, intervening around the world, creating hatred against Americans, they don't hate us because of our freedoms, they hate us because of our government intervention around the world. But there is no other country in the world that has the base of millions of people who are schooled in constitutional theory, who are willing to resist. Canada doesn't have it. England doesn't have it. Australia doesn't have it. New Zealand doesn't have it, let alone Latin America or any of the European countries. In other words, even though we're going to be the subject, I think, of a nuclear strike someday, most people will survive. They can especially survive if they follow my recommendations in strategic relocation and the secure home. But the point is, we will band together and fight this globalism. We can resist because there's such a basis of people who are already schooled in the concepts of law and freedom and liberty that exist in no other country around the world.
And that's what I've always maintained. I completely agree with you that the American psyche is just different. There are many people here who are extremely independent in their thinking, and even though people like to say Americans are a bunch of lazy lemmings and so forth, and certainly that's out there, but more so than at any other place in the world, I would agree that just instilled in the American spirit is that constitutional thinking and that thinking of fairness and small firearms. I love Hirohito, I believe it was, you know, during World War II when someone asked him if he would ever consider an invasion of the U.S., and he said something like, no way, because there's a gun behind every blade of grass in the United States. And thank God that's true. It's a really good thing. But you're right. I don't think those small arms are really as big a deal as people make them out to be, because obviously there are much more powerful weapon systems available to government and the powers that be, but it's better than nothing, right?
To occupy, it's a real problem having so many private arms hidden away that could make everybody a potential sniper. It'd be very difficult to occupy this country.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, good point. So you live in the United States, and it sounds like when you look at the global perspective, Joel, you believe that the U.S. is still the best place to be, all things considered,
right? I do. And people don't, if they live in the major population centers around the East Coast, they don't realize how much vacant land there still is in the United States from the Midwest on. I mean, you just fly over this country and you see most of it's vacant. And people don't realize that that rural vacant land is your greatest safety net, and that being in major populations is your greatest danger zone. Because when social unrest hits, and believe me, almost any shortage for more than 2 or 3 days of water, food, or electricity can cause panic. I mean, look at what's happening in London. There was maybe a spark that was considered by some perceived injustice, but this has become simply a looter's paradise of middle-class kids, spoiled kids, poor kids. It runs across the entire gamut, but there's no moral restraint left in these communities in England, and the same thing can happen here in our major inner cities.
Well, it was interesting when we were talking before we started recording as to what you said about why you live where you live. And I just found it funny, Joel, that it was so opposite of what most people might say. tell the listeners about that, if you would, when you talk about that vacant land and so forth.
The highest rated area in the United States for safety from major population centers is the Intermountain West. This is the area surrounding, if you take Salt Lake City as the center, and Salt Lake City itself isn't a particularly good city to be in, but if you look at the area surrounding it, you're separated from the major population centers by a minimum of 500 to 800 miles in all directions. I mean, you've got 1,200 miles to San Francisco through trackless wastelands of desert in Nevada. You've got 800 miles to Los Angeles through the Mojave Desert. You've got 500 miles to Denver through trackless Rocky Mountains. You just can't get to the Intermountain West in a crisis without relying on all of the modern conveniences. And as you say, a lot of people say, well, that's the reason I don't want to live in the Intermountain West. I don't want to be so isolated. But in fact, you know, you have access to all commerce because of the what we have. But when you want safety from major population threats, you have to have distance so they can't simply overwhelm you. After they've pillaged in Los Angeles, they're going to start moving out into the communities surrounding that. And eventually, a lot of people will try to get further north or east or west, but they won't be able to because of the harsh conditions and the lack of fuel and electricity.
So certainly you look at, in your analysis, population density as being a major detriment, right?
That's right. It is the most dangerous effect. If you're not in a nuclear bomb zone, it's the population density collapsing that will kill you faster than anything else. And I'm realistic to know that everybody can't move out into the country. Most people have to stay within the city. So I spend a lot of time in the book talking about contingency planning, how to move to safer areas in a metropolitan area, how to plan your exit routes. A lot of people don't realize that freeways are like moats around a city. You can't get across them except at an intersection, and those intersections will be clogged with people getting on and off the freeway. But I show in my book how there are a minority of underpasses that go through freeways exiting an area that have no exit on them, meaning it's just a straight underpass or overpass over the freeway, and there's no exit. That means they'll be free and clear, and you need to know where those are if you're going to try to get out of a major area without getting caught in the traffic.
Very interesting. See, most people would think the opposite, probably. They'd think, well, where are the freeway on-ramps
right,
so I can get on that freeway and get out of Dodge, right?
You don't want to get on a freeway because it's an island in the sky. You can't get off. There are barriers on either side of most places until you get actually way out into the west. Then you could drive off. There's no place to go. But, you know, it's like in Katrina, people got trapped on the freeway. They had to abandon their cars. And the one thing I point out in my book, which is what we learned from Katrina, is whatever you do in a crisis, you never go into the arms of government. Don't go to a FEMA camp or a FEMA facility. We found out in Katrina that they become prison camps. Nobody, once into those FEMA facilities, was free to leave without government permission.
Tell us more about that. So FEMA just kept people there and said...
Absolutely. When people entered the Superdome, and they found conditions deplorable and unsanitary and molestations going on, they literally went for the door, and they were locked, and there were guards at the door saying, for your own safety, you cannot leave until we say so. And they were prisoners. And even when people said, look, I'll go back to my house, it's safer than living in here, I have a place to go, you have no right to keep me there, you had no rights, and the government had all rights. It was just incredible, and I hope people are listening.
Let me take a brief pause. We'll be back in just a minute.
What's great about the shows you'll find on jasonhartman.com is that if you want to learn about investing in and managing income properties for college students, there's a show for that. If you want to learn how to get noticed online and in social media, there's a show for that. If you want to know how to save on life's largest expense, there's a show for that. And if you'd like to know about America's crime of the century, there's even a show for that. Yep, there's a show for just about anything. Only from jasonhartman.com. Or type in Jason Hartman in the iTunes store.
Well, that's the next thing I actually wanted to ask you about is the possibility of martial law. The false flag and the martial law that follows quickly after that, or maybe just not letting a crisis go to waste, as Rahm Emanuel would say. So you look at the escape routes from cities, for example, and that was very enlightening what you just said about the overpasses without exits and on-ramps on them being a better way out because they won't be clogged. But what about martial law? What about barricades and government control of routes and so forth?
Well, it takes a while for that to be implemented. I am not one of those on the conservative right who is crying imminent martial law. In the first place, we don't have anywhere near enough police to operate martial law. You could take what soldiers we have and add to it. You still don't have enough to control everybody getting on and off every road and control checkpoints. It takes really a good 6 months to 9 months to implement martial law, and it takes a major crisis. The worst thing government could do to convince Americans that there really is a conspiracy to take away their liberty is to call for martial law at the least little terrorist attack. I mean, look what they did after 9/11. They shut down the entire air traffic system, totally unnecessary, totally unnecessary. They could have simply had everyone land, rescan the passengers, and put everyone back into the air again. But no, they shut down, and we realized that it's government reaction to a terrorist strike, false flag or not, that is creates the most damage to the economy. Even 9/11 only killed, I mean, I don't seem to want to seem callous, only 3,000 people. But look how many billions of dollars were lost in the government's reaction in 9/11 in terms of shutting down transportation. And it could be worse under a nuclear scenario. That's why I say it's very, very important to have access to current information that is not going to be the establishment news media, because they simply distort the news mostly by what they omit, what they don't tell you, and by the most government story or stories on the mainstream media are giving, I guess, 90% coverage to what government spokesmen say. And when they have a difference of opinion, it's only a slight difference of opinion from someone who doesn't really go against the government position. They will never hear people like you or me or others who have a completely different point of view about information they don't want people to hear.
Right, and it may well be controlled opposition.
That's right, and it doesn't have to be directly controlled. Many times they're predictable people that they can simply call upon who they know will always have a predictable point of view that meets their approval. So they don't actually have to enter into a conspiracy with someone. Simply use dumbed down, predictable, or people who have sensed that we don't touch this topic because I won't ever get invited back if I do.
No, very good point. Go back and just talk about, since most people listening probably live in urban areas or suburban areas or feel they have to live in those areas, whether they really do or not is debatable. But what are some of the other preparations for an urban residence? You have a chapter on that.
One of the most important concepts is one to prepare an urban residence for contingency planning, meaning you want to be able to get out of town quickly if you can, but if you don't get out quickly and all of a sudden all the roads are clogged, it's probably better to prepare to wait it out. And that means you've got to have at least 2 weeks of supply of food and water. You've got to have some concealed storage in case there's looting where you can actually, I recommend safe rooms that are concealed so that people can get into a basement, seal themselves off where it can't be found, and they can let people go through and leave the doors open, steal what they can, but the house is left intact and their essential food and other things is left intact. That's a very important strategy rather than trying to confront waves of people with arms or violence. It's simply wiser to get out of the way into concealed space, and that takes preparation, and people can prepare in advance for that. Ultimately, I think everyone needs to have a place to go to. There's nothing worse than getting out on the roads with no place to go and getting to town after town, and every motel is filled, and every school gymnasium is filled with refugees, and people run out of food and water, and then they get into the hands of government, and now they're in refugee camps and can't leave. So I think it's very important that people have, whether it's informal networks with friends and family and neighbors, they can't afford to build a retreat themselves, they need to have prearranged places where to go and several different routes of how to get there. And they need to have kits in their car to be able to make basic repairs and have extra fuel and oil and things that they can get to places, and perhaps even have a four-wheel drive vehicle, that allows them to go off-road if necessary.
Do you get into as granular as how to secure your door? And I think I've seen your other book where you had...
I do all of that in the Secure Home. And also there's a book called How to Implement a High Security Shelter in the Home. That's how to do a safe room within a basement with concealed access. But in the Secure Home, this is my 700-page book that covers everything from security to self-sufficiency to generators to solar to safe rooms to building a fallout shelter to having the filters and, you know, the 12-volt electrical systems. Just covers everything, including, you know, how to do concealment and...
In terms of that bug-out location, when you talk about people leaving town, if they're in a city, is there an ideal distance for it? If it's too far, you know, you might just get caught up and stuck on the way or looted on the way or mugged or whatever. If it's too far away, then you have all that risk during that time of transportation. What's the ideal optimum length away from your own home that bug-out location is?
You know, this depends a lot on the area that you're in. For example, one of the advantages of the Utah area where I'm in, and one of the reasons why I chose this, is that the mountains come right down to the city. So you can get to good retreat locations by going up the canyons right out of the city within 30 minutes. And as the crow flies, it's only about 5 miles from the city. You can't do that in L.A. or Phoenix. You know, it's just not enough cover. There's not enough barrier to the city going out into those areas as there is when you have mountains. So a lot of that answer to your question depends on the terrain around where you live. If you're in the Midwest, for example, when you have no mountains at all, and you have a big major city and then just farmland going out there, you probably need to get out at least 30 to 50 miles just because to get out of the range of the waves of pillaging that will successively go out away from the city as they absorb all of the food and water and other things they can steal within the city. They start moving out into the farms, and you need to have sufficient distance. And I also like it to be so that it can ultimately be within walking distance. So something I like to see within 30 to 50 miles as a first line of retreat. 30 miles is a minimum, but 50 miles you can walk in a couple of days.
Okay, so maybe this is a silly question, but why are the mountains the safer bug-out location? Are you saying that the hordes of people that are pillaging and trying to find resources as they move out from the city, they won't go uphill?
I mean, that's right. They don't go up steep mountains. They generally are running out of energy. Except for your thug type individuals in a four-wheel drive pickup who, you know, most of your common people are not going to get up into the mountainous areas. There's also the issue of cover and concealment. In other words, when you're trying to run or flee from something, if you're just out in open terrain, you know, you're vulnerable. Once you're seen, it's just a race to see who gets to you and if somebody's after you. But having cover and concealment from trees or even hills is much, much better ultimately if you're going to get to a location. You know, you look back at what happened during World War II whenever all of the Germans in where the Russians were coming in and they were fleeing. You look at their stories of those that kept to the roads and the main flows just didn't survive. They got robbed, raped, and pillaged. There were too many people competing for two resources. The people that got way off away from the roads and went through the farmlands and didn't met more amiable farm people who were willing to help them, but the farms that were near the roads just got trashed and could help nobody. So it's important, even when one is considering a plan to get out of Dodge, to consider going very rural and having the pre-positioned supplies even to sometimes have safe locations. I mean, even on public land, you could even bury a bucket of supplies, you know, in a place that if anybody found it, you know, it wouldn't be anything illegal, but at least you know that there's something that I can get to and have some additional dried food or some rations or I've known people even to cache fuel out in rural lands that they can... get access to if they run out of fuel trying to get down.
That's really interesting. What do they do, bury it underground?
Yeah.
So they just take a gas tank and...
Well, if they use gas, of course, you have to put a stabilizer in it, like PRIG, which is a brand name, or Stabil, which people can get at AutoZone and other places. But you have to cap it also. You don't want vented gasoline because it's the evaporation of the volatiles that makes gasoline go bad. So if you cap gasoline airtight with a preservative in it, it'll last and still be good 3 and 4 years later, and perhaps longer underground where the temperature is stable. But oftentimes I recommend to clients they use diesel vehicles because diesel can be stored almost indefinitely. It's safer to store.
What about preparing to live after a nuclear attack? Most survivalists aren't really thinking too much about the nuclear threat as you are, I don't think. They're more thinking about economic collapse, it seems. That's maybe the more possible scenario in most people's eyes. How do you live after a nuclear attack?
Well, first of all, you have to understand that a nuclear winter is simply anti-nuclear propaganda. It won't be a nuclear winter. Nuclear radiation dissipates within 2 to 3 weeks, and so society will start to knit itself back together. One of the big problems, of course, if they throw an electromagnetic pulse, nuclear...
No electricity.
...knock down the grid, probably for 3 to 6 months, and during that time, you would basically have this country go back to a third world country. And that's why the only way to survive after a nuclear war scenario with a downing of the electricity is to go back, is to have a set of skills. Bartering and repair and growing food are going to be the most valuable things to do. And even if you're a person who's professional, he needs to get some basic knowledge there and stockpile some tools, equipment, and seeds that he can provide a service, because so many millions of people won't even be able to provide because they don't have anything but hybrid seeds, which, you know, once they grow, they can't collect it.
Yeah, that's the problem with Monsanto.
Yes.
Very, very evil company, if you ask me.
But being able to repair and scavenge things and make do with what those people are going to be worth their weight in gold.
Very good point.
That means you've got to have tools and some spare parts and glues and tapes. And I cover that in my little booklet, 10 Packs for Survival, how to collect all these barter items and these things that you can't manufacture. You can't manufacture super glue or duct tape. Need to stockpile that stuff.
What about the terrorism threat? I mean, do you think that's real, or do you think that's just completely overplayed? Because if you ask me, Joel, if the terrorists really wanted to get us, there are so many ways that they could get us.
Well, that's the point I've made for years, Jason, is that in my World Affairs brief, is that if we had real terrorism, we've got an open border with Mexico, they'd be streaming across, doing normal attacks of terror. They'd be bombing shopping malls, they'd be throwing explosives at electrical pylons, knocking down electric, they'd be blowing up Amtrak in the southern part of the United States. We have had not a single legitimate terrorist attack. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't terrorists. We're breeding more terrorists than we cure by our occupations in the Middle East, but they're not coming over here. Or they'd be coming already. They'd be streaming across the border.
So you know what I hear about that in the mainstream media, or as Sarah Palin calls it, the lamestream media. I love that.
Yeah.
Is that the reason Al-Qaeda doesn't do these smaller acts of terrorism is that they're very patient, and they only want to do big, flashy things like 9/11. That doesn't seem like a very good explanation to me.
Well, it isn't. In fact, it's just the opposite. When you look at Israel, which does have all kinds of acts of terrorism, it's always the small stuff.
Yeah, it's the suicide bomber.
Any little damage they can, because what does that do? That makes the people feel totally unprotected. Government can't stop the small stuff. And so it is very effective, and we should be having that too, and we don't. And that's what leads me to the conclusion that most of our terrorism, if not all of it, has been false flag terrorism. Almost all the terror prosecutions have involved agent provocateurs, i.e. FBI informants that are providing the explosives, the know-how, and goading them constantly into doing things.
Unbelievable. This is just, it's incredible. It's incredible that we've come to this. Well, Joel, tell people where they can get the book and learn more about you and all of your work. You have studied this subject intensely and written about it intensely. Where can they find out more?
Well, there are two websites that I have. One is, my basic website is joelskousen.com. That's joelskousen.com. And that covers all of my books that I've written, including Strategic Relocation. People can order online. There's also my World Affairs Brief website. That's worldaffairsbrief.com. Where it covers my weekly news analysis service. There's a modest subscription price for that. And people can get a free sample issue by emailing me at editor@worldaffairsbrief.com. Lots of free stuff to read and contemplate on the websites, so I encourage people to go there. And if you only remember one of them, you can go to worldaffairsbrief.com and get to, there's a link to joelskousen.com and vice versa.
Good stuff. Well, Joel, thank you so much for joining us today, and thank you for the information. This has been very, very informative. And listeners, the rule here, the advice here is prepare in advance. Dig your well before you're thirsty, so to speak, because this does not work after the fact. You've got to do it in advance. A prepared society is a safe society. So prepare, prepare, prepare. Thank you, Joel. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, Jason. Good to be with you.
Thank you for joining us today for the Holistic Survival Show, protecting the people, places, and profits you care about in uncertain times. Be sure to listen to our Creating Wealth show, which focuses on exploiting the financial and wealth creation opportunities in today's economy. Learn more at www.jasonhartman.com or search Jason Hartman on iTunes. This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company, offering very general guidelines and information. Opinions of guests are their own, and none of the content should be considered individual advice. If you require personalized advice, please consult an appropriate professional. Information deemed reliable, but not guaranteed.